Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is historian and educator Vivian Bruce Conger. Conger is a graduate of Cornell University and is currently an associate professor in the Department of History at Ithaca College. Her specialty and interest is in early American and American women's history. She is the author of The Widow's Mite, Widowhood and Gender in Early British America, and her upcoming book is about the little-known lives of Benjamin Franklin's wife and daughter. It's called The Worlds of Deborah Reed Franklin and Sally Franklin Bache, Transgenerational Lives in Colonial and Revolutionary Philadelphia. And welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tish, and thank goodness you had to say that and not me.
To tell us what got you interested in early American history and to follow these lives of women and so on.
Well, I'm an older student. I went to college right out of high school, hated it, failed at it miserably, was a secretary for 8 years. And when I decided to go back to college, I said, I just want to do something that I loved. And I knew somehow that early history touched my soul. Mm. I can't tell you any more than that why. It just something that resonated to me. And I said to my husband, if I'm going back to school to get a degree at age 31, I'm going to do something I really love, and history is what I want to do.
Wow, that's great to know that.
Now, he was a little sad that I didn't go into computer science and make big bucks, but that's all right. He's happy anyway. But it seems a lot of the decision I make are because I love it, or it's happened in terms of serendipity, but I didn't start out thinking about doing women's history. I didn't think, okay, I'm going back to college, I'm going to study early American history, I'm going to study women. But when I got back into school, I started reading about women, and I became very interested. And it seemed to me every research paper I did as an undergraduate was about a woman in some way or about women in some way.
Yeah.
And it just sort of, again, something that interested me and something I knew I needed to pursue, and I love studying
that. Well, I think it's a way for us to find out who we are, too, obviously. I mean, history does that. But, you know, women have not been written into history in many ways. Of course, the second generation of the feminist movement, people have started to. But do you think that was one of your motivations, too? Because there still isn't a lot known.
Well, I was and still am, and I have no problem saying this word, a feminist. So I understood women's lives politically in the contemporary world, and I would think about women's lives now and think about them in terms of history and see how they diverged or how they came together and what we could learn from women's lives back then and bring to our lives now.
Well, that's always interested me, too. Like I told you that I was curious how women forged identities in cultures that were pretty sexist, where women didn't have very many opportunities. So let's talk about your first book called The Widow's Mite. It's called Widowhood and Gender in Early British America. What made you get interested in widows? I had never even thought of that.
Well, I'm going to tell you the truth, Tish. When I finished my coursework and took all my exams at Cornell, and it was time to sit down and think about what I wanted to study for what I wanted my dissertation to be on. And I was talking with my major professor, Mary Beth Norton. Mm-hmm. And of course, she does early women's history, and she knew I loved early women's history. And I was very interested in women's economic lives at the moment. So we sat down one afternoon, and she said, I've just been talking with my best friend, another early American women's historian, and she said, you should think about doing widows' wills. Mm. There's been a lot of studies on men's wills, but no one's looked at widows' wills.
And I would never have thought widows were even allowed to leave wills in those days, you know?
Well,
so this
married women were not allowed to leave wills, but widows could,
yeah,
because they were no longer sort of femme covert. They had gone back to femme sole. That is basically a single woman. And so they had the legal rights that they had lost as married women. And so she said, spend about 6 months looking at widows' wills, just getting a sense, what can you do with them? And so I spent a lot of time looking at their wills and thinking about, I cared a lot about the property they left. mean, historians would say, oh, widows don't matter because they had no landed property. We don't care about them. Well, some women did, in fact, have landed property.
Oh, absolutely.
They had other kind of properties that mattered a lot to their families, their personal property, and cash and outstanding loans that mattered a lot. So I wanted to see who they left them to. Is there a female network, intergenerational network there? Did widows leave stuff to their daughters in the way that men didn't? And so I got thinking about that.
So what did you find out about that? Tell us a little bit about the details that you did find.
Well, in fact, widows did leave land to daughters. When people said, oh, no, only sons got land, they left land to daughters or granddaughters. They left all sorts of personal property to daughters that mattered a lot. Daughters could take that personal property and take it into a marriage and have an economic position there. They had their own wealth. I looked at Maryland, South Carolina, and Massachusetts. And so I'm looking at northern and southern states. When I'm talking about southern states, I'm looking at slaves and how slaves were bequeathed. They were very important property.
God, I know that's amazing. When I was reading the book, I thought, my God, that is so strange to think of.
I know.
Yeah.
It's a sad reality, but it gave women some economic power and
white
position.
Women.
White
economic
women, yes.
Power, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you for clarifying that.
It
certainly didn't give the slave women any power.
That's right. Well, you know, women were so under control of their husbands, and so when their husbands died and they were empowered in many ways, right?
Yes,
to write
were.
Wills, to have this property, to learn new skills. To talk to us a little bit about that, too.
So let's not forget initially that it's a really sad thing to lose your husband, right? It could be very traumatic for a lot of widows. They're left alone and all these new duties and new responsibilities, but they did have to rise to the occasion. It's not like they could just simply fall apart.
Yeah, it's just like women in all eras.
That's right. They learned to sort of come to grips with their lives. They had to manage property, even if it wasn't a lot. They still had lives to live, children to raise. And so they really did learn to rise to the occasion.
And they learned to be leaders in many ways.
They were leaders. There were all sorts of, what I found really interesting was all sorts of advice literature.
You know, I was going to bring that up, conduct books that
conduct
you were talking about.
About widows. This is the interesting thing about how your project changes and grows and evolves. So I was just going to look at widows' wills, but I needed to understand what the constraints women were under, how people saw widows. Should widows remarry? I mean, a lot of widows did remarry.
Yeah, especially the younger ones, right?
Yes, mm-hmm. And a lot of women didn't. And so how did their societies, their culture, think about whether they should remarry or not? There's all sorts of advice literature saying, yes, you should marry. No, you shouldn't marry. And I sat down, and I remember being frustrated. And I had said to Mary Beth, I can't find a clear pattern. There's neither yes nor no. Mm-hmm. And she said, then that's your story,
of course. I was going to say, did you just think how they felt?
That's right. She said,
exactly.
They're getting all these competing messages. That's your story is the complexity in the different messages they're getting. You know, if there were young, they're seen as sexually threatening to the community. They've had sex, their experience sexually. What does it mean to have a single woman in their community ungoverned by a man?
Yeah, yeah.
But if they're older, they're often seen as prizes for young men because they have money, and so they're a valuable commodity.
You know, the scary thing is nothing has changed, has it, in that respect? But you know what interested me, too, in this book, the way some religious aspects would come in, and they'd tell women to give themselves over to God instead of finding a new husband.
Yes.
That was a way to control them, too.
That was a way to make them safe. They weren't going to threaten the community, and so God was their husband, basically, like nuns almost.
Yeah, yeah.
And they'd say, go to your closet. They don't mean literally like closet like we understand it, but a room where you would go and be alone and think and pray to God and be a well-behaved woman, actually.
But were there any major surprises that you found during this research about widows?
The surprises I found were actually the extent to which they did have property to leave and to whom they left it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, all the literature almost universally said widows don't matter. And I found out that they'd mattered a lot in their communities economically, and not just their wills. These are women who I learned were shopkeepers, who had land. They rented it. They sold it. They were very much involved in the marketplace of goods and property.
I know we never think of women that way in that era.
We don't.
Because we haven't read very much about what their lives were really about.
We just think that, you know, I have my students will say to me a lot, well, sort of they're like slaves to their husband, and I want to stop them and say, no, I mean, I know this is what we've been taught for a long time, but they're not, and they have a voice, and we need to listen to them.
Yeah, yeah. So that's the surprising thing that I read in that book that perhaps you were surprised by, too.
Yeah. Yes, wow. I was. And I was excited to find it. You know, I'm going to spend 3 or 4 years studying widows and looking at their wills. I mean, I was looking at, thank goodness for the LDS Church and their family history library. I spent like 2.5 years whenever they were open. I think Tuesday, Thursday for a couple of hours and Saturdays for a couple of hours, just ordering microfilms and cranking through original handwritten wills.
Oh, that must have been fascinating.
It was fascinating, and I love the women who were there. Every once in a while, they say, oh, dear, a holiday's coming up, or we have to close. But one of us will come in and stay open for you so you can do your research.
Oh, that's great.
That was so wonderful for me.
Yeah, yeah. That's all part of the process, too. I mean, not just the book. It's the whole process that must be so fascinating as a historian.
Because I designed a rather complex, I'm looking at 3 colonies, and in fact, I had originally thought I would do New York because it's a different one. I just thought, I've got to get out of school eventually. I could keep doing this for years and years and years, but I want to get out and start my career and get this project done. And so I cut that out. But it was still a fairly complex project to do that for 3 colonies. And I went to all of those areas to see what kind of letters or other kind of documents I could find written by or about widows. Now, there wasn't a lot, but you have to do the digging to know what you're getting.
Yeah, because there is it's available. We just have to unveil it somehow.
That's
now,
right.
Let's talk about some of your new research, which I find absolutely fascinating, too. You have an upcoming book about Benjamin Franklin's wife, Deborah, and her daughter, and their daughter, Sally Bache. So talk to us about how you got interested in honing in on those two.
Well, again, you know, it's a kind of an unromantic story, I thought. When I got into my next project, I said, okay, I think I want to find something more focused than trying to do 3 comparative colonies. I knew I was always going to study women. I will never not study women. Mm. And so I probably cast around for a year. I wanted sources that were more easily available. And as dumb as that sounds, I just thought, okay, this next research project's got to be a little simpler for me. Since I'm teaching, I don't have the freedom that I had in graduate school to take the time and do all that traveling. And I read an article in a magazine. The guy that wrote it was talking about these letters between Deborah Franklin and Benjamin Franklin and talking a lot about consumer goods. He was in England. She was in Philadelphia. They were exchanging cloth and tea sets and window paneling and slips and dresses and all sorts of things. And I was teaching a senior seminar on early American consumer culture. I thought, well, this might be interesting for my students to explore. And I asked him about it. He said, all these letters are published. In fact, they are. In fact, now they're all online, but they're published and they're right on the shelves, as it turns out, of Ithaca College and probably every library in the world, because it is the letters of Benjamin Franklin.
If you're just joining us, my guest is historian Vivian Bruce Conger. We're talking about her new research about Benjamin Franklin's wife, Deborah, and daughter, Sally. She's going to be producing a book about this subject. Continue to tell us more about why you got into this.
Well, then I thought, this could be my next project. why tell my students about it when, in fact, it's something I'm very interested in? I didn't know what to make of it. Again, a topic sort of reared its beautiful head. I was going to say ugly head, but reared its beautiful head. And so I started digging into it. And then there was a conference in England put out by the journal Gender and History, and it was called Homes and Homecomings. And I knew Deborah Franklin had, while Benjamin was away, overseen finishing the construction of their new house in Philadelphia. And I thought, oh, homes. I mean, that's a literal construction of a home, a house. And Benjamin came back at least one time. Well, he traveled to England twice, came back once, and when he left the second time, he never saw Deborah alive again. So then I presented this paper, and then I just got involved in it and got deeper
fascinating, too, because he was gone so much. She did have to rise to the occasion. And Deborah and her daughter were witness to the early revolutionary days of America. And they had to forge their own lives because Benjamin Franklin was gone and a famous, prominent man away a lot. So talk to us about how you did this, the rest of this research into them. Was it mainly reading letters?
It was absolutely reading letters. I've gotten into a few other things, but to sit down, this a rich body of letters between Deborah and Benjamin and between Sally and Benjamin later on. Then I went to the American Philosophical Society, and they have letters that were not published in the volume because they are from people to Deborah or to Sally, not Benjamin.
Mm.
And so that didn't seem worthy of, you know, the papers of Benjamin Franklin is where these letters are. Letters from other people other than Benjamin
didn't seem worthy
to put in that book. So I have
some.
It's wonderful. The original, I could look at those original documents. I was not allowed to look at the original letters between Deborah and Ben because it's all published. And I understand they're old documents. They want to preserve them. But I could look at the original documents written mainly to Deborah and Sally. We don't have the other, you know, they send those letters out.
Well, see, that's the same way that history, women were written out of history,
or
they were not put into history. Because, I mean, these women had to learn skills, and they were obviously involved in their community.
Oh, it's amazing to me to see. I started thinking about Deborah this way, built on my project on widowhood, because I see her as a surrogate widow. Mm. Benjamin is gone from about 1757. She died in 1774. He came back briefly, but spent most of those last 15 years of her life away. So she, in fact, became what I would call a surrogate widow.
Yeah.
She's not legally a widow,
mm-hmm.
but she is in the Philadelphia community. She has all sorts of social and economic networks. She's meeting, you know, walking the streets of Philadelphia. She's going to market. She's dealing with men and women.
She's raising this kid.
She's raising this kid, and she's making deals. She's collecting rent. She's buying property, in fact. She has an amazing network in Philadelphia that I think people have not understood. I'm starting now to sort of chart it out in visual form. I'm using a sort of a social network technology, because I want to sort of look visually at her network and how deep and rich it is. I don't think Sally's is quite as deep, but they're in Philadelphia at different times and dealing with different issues.
Yeah, yeah.
But I have read the letters, every one of those letters. In fact, I've taken notes on every one of those letters. So that's probably 20 volumes, and I've gone back to write various papers and looked at specific parts of them. I have a student who's working with me now. She's going through and helping me do some analysis, bringing me back closer and closer to the letters again. And so it's just a matter of reading and rereading and figuring out what is exactly in those letters.
Yeah, and these women had rich lives, and it's amazing that they weren't written into most of Ben Franklin's autobiography. Either his autobiography or the biographies, hundreds of them about him. You know, one thing that you did say, you said we need to rethink what so-called ordinary women did in that culture, in that early culture. And it wasn't that unusual for women to work in the public sphere. So Deborah was sort of the launching pad for you to start thinking in those terms,
right?
It
was, actually. Once I started this project, I started going to conferences and giving papers and talking with other women. And we're more and more saying, we're giving papers on what we say. Gee, how extraordinary this is. But if you think about, there's 20, 30 of us who are writing about women in the 18th century doing these so-called extraordinary things, but it's seeming not so extraordinary.
This sounds like it's part of the culture, yeah.
Did. And we need to understand that this is their daily lives.
Well, why do you think that is, though, Vivian? As a historian who's on this road now, why have women continued to be written out of history by men, by other women? Well, why is that?
Well, if I think about this in terms of the American Revolution, for example, because mm-hmm. this is where I can get in and talk about Deborah and Sally. We think about the American Revolution as this event where all sorts of really big, important things happened. Stamp Act crisis, non-importation agreements. Are you marching in the streets and sort of being a good patriot? Or are you being a loyalist and getting in trouble? We look at these big events, and a lot of times women aren't seen at these big events, even though they're doing things all along. We tend to not think of them as sort of patriots.
But that has continued up to our modern times. We don't think of women being involved in the civil rights movement as much.
Absolutely.
We think of Martin Luther King.
Of course.
So it continues to this day.
It does continue. And do I dare say it's just the patriarchy and the sexism of the world we still live in?
But it almost feels like somebody's afraid to reveal women's lives because it would empower, and it shows power. And I think there's still a fear of that.
It's very interesting. There's one historian who is very hard on Deborah. And I'm beginning to take it personally, which is probably the problem of a biographer, is I'm becoming very involved in Deborah's life. In Debbie's life. I call her Debbie. I mean, we're friends. And this is what Ben called her all the time, my dear Debbie. So I call her Debbie. But there's some historians who are very hard on her.
And in what way, though? She was a meaningless entity in the...
Well, they would... In fact, I think it's more than meaningless. Let me give you one example. Deborah Franklin was afraid to death to travel on the sea. Mm. She refused to go with Benjamin to England when he went. He would say, come over. She would say no. She was scared to death of traveling by sea. And she's seen by a historian in particular as sort of being backwater, ignorant, kind of almost country bumpkin, but she's living in Philadelphia in the 18th century, for goodness sake. She's hardly that.
She's obviously literate.
She's literate. And she reads the newspapers, but he said, why wouldn't she sort of... She understood that she didn't have the skill and the grace to live up to her husband's life in England, and so she chose to kind of hide back in the shadows.
Talking about your editorializing too much scholarly
I started looking at 18th century newspapers, and I would see, because I thought, well, is there a reason, or is she just paranoid? But you look at the 18th century newspapers, there's articles all the time about ships that have been captured by pirates. Terrifying in itself. People are killed. Ships sink. I can understand.
Yes.
I don't like to fly. So it'd be that same sort of... I mean, I do fly, but it's that same sort of fear of flying or fear of traveling by boat. There is some logic to it.
Oh, absolutely. People need to look into the reasons. That's what biography is about in regard to people's lives.
Deborah kept... she rubbed elbows with all the rich and famous people in Philadelphia in Ben's absence. She stood in his place, kept his social and political connections, met with them, talked with them, had them to her house. It's not like she lacked any social graces or connections.
You know what I'm going to ask you, too? Because Benjamin Franklin was a prominent man, do you think that gave Deborah opportunities that other women, that we'll never know about, that other women you know, normal women, let's say, didn't have.
That's absolutely true. I mean,
and the same for the daughter, right?
He had, you know, he would write her and said, okay, say hello to my friends. And he would list the whole long list of friends that he had. And so she's making those social connections for him in his absence. So I struggle a lot because I see her as an ordinary woman.
Mm.
But I see her also as a woman married to a very famous man. But she's doing the things that women did. You know, went to market and, you know, raised kids on their own. And so in some sense, this is the part I'm probably struggling with the most. How do I see her? Mm-hmm. She's some sort of combination of ordinary, middle class, elite, well-connected woman. So, yes, she does have. Ben helps her a lot in that regard.
Yeah, as a prominent man.
In
a major city, of course,
by
Philadelphia.
By 1757, they've made their money. He's retired from the shop. He's not a printer anymore. He can go and be a politician. Mm-hmm. And she's now that sort of local politician or a different kind of politician.
You know what you talk about also in the excerpts I've read from the forthcoming book is the fact that Deborah and her daughter were both involved in the health issues and medical issues and, you know, hospital settings and stuff. So talk to us about that.
You know, these women's lives were very similar, but they're very different. For example, Deborah Franklin was very involved in nursing friends and family in her community, which would have been usual for women. This is what they did. Nursing, helping out. Deborah visited houses, helped people, had a reputation for it. People understood her. People from Massachusetts wrote her a letter about medicines and caring for her, that they'd visited her and she'd cared for them. When Sally faced, she faced a different situation. She was facing the yellow fever epidemic, but she didn't do the nursing, at least as I can tell from the letters, the way her mother did.
Wow.
The city had changed and women's lives had changed. But this is what's fascinating about these two women for me.
Yeah. I can't wait till the book comes out.
Me neither.
So you're delving into history tells us a lot about our day and age now, right? We only have a couple minutes left. You want to tell us how it affects us now to know about these women's lives?
Well, I mean, it can give us role models. Young women could read this and say, wow, look at what these women accomplished in the past. We can do that in our own lives. You can look at how women's lives and why they and how women's lives and why women's lives changed over time. You can understand their role, their agency in all of this. Women are just not passive. They are active actors in their own lives, and they can sort of chart the direction of their own lives. And so they make nice role models for young women.
Vivian Bruce Conger, thank you so much for joining us. Do you want to give some contact information in case somebody wants to get in touch?
They can contact me at the Department of History at Ithaca College. You can go on the History Department website. You can find information on how to get me there.
Great. Vivian Bruce Conger, she's an associate professor in the History Department at Ithaca College, and her forthcoming book is coming out soon about Deborah Reed Franklin and her daughter, Sally Franklin Bache. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tish. It was fun.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outoboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.